The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Cold War politics, how the Ukraine crisis is dividing Democrats and Republicans, and how it may shape coming elections for Congress and the White House.
The Crimea conundrum, centuries of competition over the strategic peninsula, helped define the current confrontation between Kiev and Moscow.
What price salvation? A new report considers costs that come with aid from the International Monetary Fund, most recently in the Mideast, maybe next in Ukraine.
A Child's China. American artist and illustrator James McMullen writes and paints his memories of a Chinese childhood until World War II fragmented his family.
Have you met Miss Jones? Of course. Shirley Jones attained stardom young in musical theater and film, and now approaching 80 in the intimate world of cabaret.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of March 9th and Daylight Savings Time, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote, "Enough is enough." That was Republican Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa supporting a bill to have professional military prosecutors, not unit commanders, decide on prosecuting growing cases of sexual assault in the armed forces. But there was not enough support to bring New York Senator Christine Gillibrand's legislation to a vote. Also last week, Brigadier General Jeffrey A. Sinclair, a former top Afghanistan commander, admitted to charges involving adultery and pornography, but could not forestall his trial for alleged sexual assault on a junior officer with whom he was having an affair. And the Army suspended its top sexual assault prosecutor after charges he groped a female lawyer at a sexual assault conference. Now this.
This morning, I signed an executive order that authorizes sanctions on individuals and entities responsible for violating the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine.
Every time the president goes on national television and threatens Putin or anyone like Putin, everybody's eyes roll, including mine.
This is the ultimate result of a feckless foreign policy where nobody believes in America's strength anymore.
With fear rising of a new Cold War over Crimea and the larger Ukraine, related politics back home last week grew ever more heated. Though Republicans were hard-pressed to tout non-military responses much tougher than those ordered by Barack Obama, the rhetorical attacks by GOP senators like Lindsey Graham and John McCain on the president's previous foreign policy action or inaction grew ever more shrill as party leaders jockeyed for position and influence in upcoming midterm elections and beyond.
To consider both presidential and partisan reactions to the Ukraine crisis and other political developments of the week, for your ears only, we're joined again by Princeton Professor of History and Public Affairs, Julian Zelizer. His books include the biography Jimmy Carter, Governing America, and Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Republicans blame Obama's restrained response to previous provocations, the terrorist attack in Benghazi, Syria's use of chemical weapons, for emboldening Russian President Vladimir Putin. Now, others say Putin was provoked in part by the policies of past U.S. presidents in expanding the NATO alliance ever closer to Russia's borders, accommodating Russian advances in former Soviet Georgia. What's your view?
Putin doesn't need to be emboldened by President Obama. This is very much part of who he is, and aggressive posture is something that comes naturally to him. This is a problem that President Bush faced as well. So I think there's many factors behind why he's doing this, many internal to Ukraine and the long history between Russia and Ukraine. But I don't think it's accurate, ultimately, to blame things like Benghazi for what's gone on.
The immediate provocation for Putin was clearly violent protest in Kiev for closer ties to Europe and against the corrupt regime of Viktor Yanukovych, who finally fled. And the Russians recorded State Department calls about supporting forces for democratic change. What's the lesson there?
I think the internal politics and the division within the Ukraine between a part that's much more Western and a part that's much more tied to Russia goes back, a long time. And so these kinds of diplomatic cables can trigger fears in this region and open up these kinds of tensions and internal battles.
Would Congress support the cost to American businesses from greater economic sanctions on their trade with Russia?
I think they might do so hesitantly, but not indefinitely. I think a lot of American business wants to open up this huge market and continue the changes that have taken place in the past few decades.
What about greater efforts to have U.S. natural gas replace Russian supplies and leverage?
Well, that's an option, but according to all the studies that have come out in the past few days, that will have very limited effect, and it will be limited in terms of what the U.S. can do and limited in terms of freeing Europe from its dependence on those oil resources.
How much impact do you think the Ukraine crisis will have on this year's midterm elections, especially the GOP primaries and the 2016 presidential race?
I think it will be limited. This has emerged suddenly, and nor is it an issue that I think will resonate with a lot of the electorate. It will be a way to talk about President Obama's leadership or the promise of what Republicans have to offer. But I think these midterms will remain midterms that revolve around the GOP, how do you govern the economy, and Obama's health care program.
How did you read the way various issues were raised at last week's Conservative Political Action Conference, where Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell brandished a rifle and Chris Christie continued to stress the importance of political victory as well as principle?
Well, it reflected very clearly the division within the Republican Party about what the strategy should be. McConnell, who's facing his own Tea Party challenge, is relying on the traditional aggressive and somewhat hysterical rhetoric that some Republicans employ, while Christie is making a different kind of argument and talking about the need for ideas, the need for a positive vision. Both men face political challenges at home, and both are taking very different strategies for what the GOP should be about.
I seem to see a lot of conflicting polls. Given all the division within GOP ranks, Tea Party versus more mainstream, how do you see its prospects in the midterms?
I think the prospects still lean toward the Republicans. Historically, these midterms, the second midterms a president faces like this, don't go well for the president in power. President Clinton is the only exception. So the GOP still has history on its side. And the polls show that overall the Democrats are still in more trouble right now for the midterms, even with all these tensions that are playing out within the GOP.
Do you think Obama's continued delaying mandates of Obamacare is making his health care reform more or less of a target for Republicans?
I think it makes it more of a target in that they can argue the president is having problems with the program. They can use the delays as evidence that their arguments were correct all along. And I think symbolically, it just gives the impression that President Obama is not totally in control or in command of this program that's the centerpiece of his agenda. So I think Republicans in local races are going to use those delays as evidence of their claim.
While nobody can be sure how Hillary Clinton will decide on running for president, everyone, including Vice President Joe Biden, agrees that Biden would be a likely alternative if she doesn't. But you write that political history is against him.
Yeah, vice presidents don't do well when they run for office. The only vice president in the 20th century who was able to pull this off was George H.W. Bush in 1988, and then there were a few in the 19th century. There's a lot of baggage that comes when you're the vice president, and it's very hard to follow the person you've worked with. You're just seen in some ways as the status quo, and you inherit all the problems of the administration without all the benefits.
And while Hillary rides highest in the polls now, how do you see her public and private record affecting her potential candidacy?
It's going to be a challenge. Look, Hillary Clinton's great virtue is experience, her record, her time in Washington. She very much knows how this place runs, and she can bring that to the table as a leader. On the other hand, all of that is also a vice, because all these stories will come out about what she did in the past. People were reminded of all the scandals, and that is something she's going to have to deal with as she launches her campaign, assuming she does that.
Princeton Professor of History and Public Affairs Julian Zelizer. His books include Jimmy Carter, Governing America, and Arsenal of Democracy.
Here's a quote from the news. Deporter-in-chief. That was Latino advocacy leader Janet Merguia deriding President Obama's claim that record deportations under his administration, now nearing 2 million, were required by law, though he previously found a way around it to keep undocumented young dreamers in the country.
Next, the Crimea conundrum. Ages in the making. For your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. If they wanted to avoid a confrontation between these groups, why didn't they intervene? That was Caracas resident Jose Contreras on the failure of Venezuelan police and National Guard to prevent a melee between anti-government demonstrators and a motorcycle gang that killed one soldier and a civilian, which raised to 21 the death toll in continuing protests against the regime of Nicolas Maduro. Now this.
This referendum is unconstitutional. And again, as I'm saying, we need to bring the whole discussion into the constitutional field.
A pro-Russian crowd chanted outside the Crimean parliament last week, brandishing signs that proclaimed, in English, "Stop assisting fascism in Kiev." Also with international media in mind were the cries, in English, of a topless female counter-demonstrator being dragged off by police. The Ukrainian economy minister was fully dressed while disputing the legitimacy of Crimea's threatened referendum on rejoining Russia, but his argument was at least somewhat undermined by the street violence in Kiev that forced out legally elected President Viktor Yanukovych.
To consider the long and contentious connections of Crimea, Ukraine, and Russia, and the dangers for them and the wider world going forward, for your ears only, we're joined by Professor Stephen Miner, director of Ohio University's Contemporary History Institute and expert on Russian, Soviet, and Eastern European history. His books include Between Churchill and Stalin and Origins of the Grand Alliance and Stalin's Holy War. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you.
You've painted a picture of Putin acting more out of anxiety than aggression, anxiety that Ukraine could become a NATO ally right on Russia's border, and anxiety of people power disrupting other areas within Moscow's perceived sphere of influence. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think that people are not fully aware that Russia still remains a multinational country. It's not a unified nation state. And there are separatist areas within Russia itself. And I think one of the concerns on the part of Putin is he runs an authoritarian government. He's cracked down on demonstrators in his own country. And he's afraid that, or is concerned, that if Ukraine is allowed to slip away from Moscow's control and domination, this kind of power from below could spread to Russia itself, and Russia could disintegrate.
Earlier in the crisis, some analysts said Putin didn't really want to take back Crimea because its big Russian population and Russian naval base gave him unique influence on Ukrainian policy. Was that true? And if so, do you think his calculation has really changed, or is support for the Crimea referendum now just a bargaining chip?
You know, when it comes to Putin himself, we're all guessing because we don't know exactly what he's aiming at. He could have maximalist aims and he could have minimalist aims. The maximalist could be to annex eastern Ukraine or Ukraine itself, along with the Crimea. Or it could be that he's using this as a bargaining chip to have some kind of say over what an independent, a quasi-independent Ukraine could do. I can imagine him. One hopeful thing in all of this is that he maintains the fiction, and it is a fiction, that these forces are not Russian forces, that they're local self-defense forces. This may be a way of him allowing himself a pullback in exchange for some kind of negotiated compromise. On the other hand, he could be going for the whole of the Ukraine, in which case we're in for some trouble for a long time. Indications in the future indications where he might go can be seen in Georgia, where he's still hanging on to Abkhazia, he's still hanging on to Ossetia, and also in Transnistria, which is also in the west near Moldova, which is also occupied by Russian troops. So there's precedent for what he's doing in Crimea.
Well, that raises the question. People say that the world would not recognize Crimea independent or reattached to Russia. But those areas of the former Soviet Georgia that you mentioned did break away. Russia is the only country that recognized them. But life goes on. What really would be the impact on Crimea if it goes ahead with its referendum and does break away either more or less from Ukraine?
I think there's precious little we can do in the short term to force Russia out if it's determined to pay an economic price to keep these areas. But the future lasts a long time. And you'll remember that the Baltic states were incorporated into the Soviet Union back in 1940. And the Soviets, that seemed to be eternal, and we seemed to think we had to accept that. But we never recognized it. And ultimately, they were able to reestablish their independence. So I think not recognizing something is a long-term marker that, okay, you've got this, you've got the power to enforce it, but we don't accept it, and the worm will turn eventually.
One key to Russian leverage on Ukraine and Western Europe is its supply of oil and natural gas. How much of a counterweight anytime soon do you see in supplying more of America's new glut of natural gas to the area?
That's a good question. The Russians supply about a third of Europe's needs of natural gas. And, of course, the United States has all of these new fields of natural gas opening up. But natural gas flows, and the flow has to not be interrupted. You can store it, but you can only store a certain amount. We don't have transmission of natural gas from the United States to Europe. You can do this sort of stuff with liquid natural gas and stuff like that. But the Russians have pipelines, and pipelines are much more economical, and they're much more easy to operate. They flow better, and they can also be shut off very quickly.
Meantime, Congress has voted on $1 billion in aid for Ukraine, and the International Monetary Fund is apparently okay with a $15 billion loan. What more outside support could help stabilize the situation and keep Crimea maybe with some more independence?
I think that we could do a number of things in terms of supporting the government. We could certainly train, for example, their police force. We could also perhaps supply their military and make clear to the Russians that, in fact, you don't go into the ethnically Ukrainian parts or you're going to face some kind of resistance. But I think it's mostly economic assistance that would help. And I think diversifying their energy resources is task number one, because as long as the Russians control that, they can control the lifeline of Ukraine.
There seems to be a shift in China's policy on the situation, no longer stressing the importance of Ukraine's territorial integrity. But doesn't China also have to worry about encouraging breakaways among its own many ethnic and geographic constituencies?
You're right. They're stuck in a contradiction. They have separatist movements in Xinjiang and in Tibet, and they don't want to encourage separatism. But this is separatism of Ukraine, and they see Ukraine really as a traditional part of a Russian geostrategic space. And so they don't see this as separatism. They see this rather as restoration, I think. And also they're pulling closer to Russia because they have their own problems with the United States, and both Russia and China think that America is past its prime.
Here's a question we just asked our previous guest, Princeton professor Julian Zelizer. Do you think Republicans are right to blame President Obama's restrained response to previous provocations, the terrorist attack in Benghazi, Syria's use of chemical weapons, for emboldening Putin? Or was he provoked more by the policies of past U.S. presidents in expanding the NATO alliance ever closer to Russia's border and accommodating those Russian advances in Georgia?
I think to say that Obama's past performance has emboldened Putin is sort of simplistic. He has expressed his contempt for Obama quite openly. He has been worried about the expansion of NATO from Obama's predecessors. I think Obama's earlier moves in canceling the anti-missile deployments in Poland and in the Czech Republic was a strategic mistake, and it's something that he'll probably now have to rectify. But right now, I don't think anybody, even the most formidable of presidents, could have a whole lot of tools in his tool bag to force the Russians to act quickly to disgorge Crimea.
Professor Stephen Miner is director of Ohio University's Contemporary History Institute. His books include Between Churchill and Stalin and Origins of the Grand Alliance and Stalin's Holy War.
Quote from the news, "She screamed terribly and yelled for help. Then it was bang, 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 bang." That was Michelle Berger, neighbor of South African Olympian Oscar Pistorius, testifying at his trial for the fatal shooting of girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp.
Next, more on the IMF's double-edged financial sword. For your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote, a huge proof of concept that you can cure someone if you can treat them early enough. That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, executive director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, on reports that a second baby born with HIV had apparently been cured by immediate administration of HIV suppression drugs. Also last week, two studies found 100% protection against AIDS in monkeys that got monthly injections of a retroviral drug, which could lead to a breakthrough in human AIDS prevention. Now this.
A team of negotiators from the International Monetary Fund is heading to Kiev to meet Ukraine's self-proclaimed authorities. They'll be discussing the terms of a crucial loan to save the country from default. Kiev is seeking $15 billion in aid, which falls well short of the estimated $35 billion that it will need by the end of 2015 to keep the economy afloat.
At the weekend, newly named Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said Ukraine had secured that $15 billion in aid and that Kiev should receive the first $2 billion shortly. IMF European Department Director Reza Mogadam, after his trip to Kiev, was impressed by Ukraine's commitment to economic changes and said that the fund was ready to further help stabilize the country's failing economy.
But how effective will it prove, and with what social and political costs? Those questions focus special interest on a new investigation of how the IMF process and requirements recently impacted Mideast nations, where people power in squares and streets also changed regimes in the so-called Arab Spring. The study was conducted by the New America Foundation's Middle East Task Force in collaboration with the Arab NGO Network for Development and the Egyptian Center for Economic and Social Rights. To talk about its findings and recommendations for Your Ears Only, we're joined by New America's Task Force Director, Leila Hilal. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
First, tell us in which countries and from what sources the findings for this report were drawn.
So we researched IMF staff reports for five countries of the Middle East and North Africa that are currently or were undergoing political transitions and or major reforms following the uprisings of 2011 and had historically had significant engagement with the IMF, those countries being Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, Tunisia, and Yemen. We also conducted extensive consultations with civil society leaders.
The major focus of your report seems to be the IMF's consistent advice to longstanding and reshaped Arab governments to dramatically reform or repeal subsidies for food and energy. How do those subsidies work?
The economies of the Middle East and North African region are the most heavily subsidized in the world, with energy subsidies or fuel subsidies being particularly staggering, amounting to nearly 8.5% of the region's GDP in 2011, or $240 billion. What happens is the government will cover the cost of the market fluctuations to ensure that the consumer will pay the same amount for petrol and fuel purchases, even though the prices may be higher at the global level.
Talk about how major changes in subsidies, especially for food, has impacted the health and welfare of populations involved, particularly the poor.
Well, we didn't do in-depth quantitative research on impact on the rich and or on the poor. But what we believe is that the IMF undervalues that kind of impact, and we know that that the poor certainly rely on these subsidies. Let's say for food, for bread, for cheaper staples. And if the removal of those subsidies goes forward, then lower-income persons are going to be paying more for basic needs.
And there have been fatal protests and other political pushback in Jordan, Egypt, Sudan. Remind us.
Well, we have seen a direct correlation between public unrest and major subsidy reforms. Overwhelmingly, implementation of such advice to cut subsidies has resulted in popular backlash and economic upheaval. For example, in Egypt in 1977, there was a repeal of food subsidies, and that provoked widespread rioting. Jordan also has attempted to cut subsidies in 1989 and 1996. Similarly triggering rioting and unrest. And then just recently we saw in Sudan in September of last year, very violent, protesting and then very violent crackdown on those protesters that left 50 people dead. Our report accepts the notion that these subsidy expenditures should be ended, but how they're done and under what conditions are important, so that the lower income people, the fundamental population, doesn't feel the impact.
The report makes several recommendations to the IMF, including other short-term alternatives to subsidy reform. Can you give us some examples?
Sure. Well, we produced this report, as you mentioned, in partnership with organizations in the region, and there are large movements afoot among civil society in these countries to promote debt relief over further loan obligations being assumed. There is also some recommendations on progressive taxation ensuring a better targeting of subsidy reform and improving social safety nets. Finally, the other important recommendation that we touch on is that we propose that some of the recommendations that need to be made from multilateral institutions and Western powers is for governments to cut back on military spending, which could help them consolidate fiscally.
Leila Hilal is director of New America Foundation's Middle East Task Force.
Money, 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 mark a yen, a buck for a bum. That clinking, clanking, clunking sound is going that makes the world go round. It makes the world go round.
Quote from the news, people will always want an edge, and test changes always spur demand. That was Seppi Basili, vice president of Kaplan Test Prep, after the announcement of changes in the Scholastic Aptitude Test to conform more to actual high school learning, with a less rarefied vocabulary test and an essay that's only optional.
Next, chilling childhood memories of China in World War II, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Terrorists don't represent any ethnic group. They don't represent any religion. Their act of violence is simply anti-human and anti-society. That was Noor Bekri, governor of Xinjiang, China, ordering a crackdown on violent separatist groups after a bizarre knife attack in the southwestern city of Kunming that left 29 dead and 140 injured, unofficially attributed to the region's Uyghur Muslim minority. Also last week, Chinese officials shuttered the elaborate sex trade that made the city of Dongguan a major tourist attraction. Now this.
Music from Shen Yan, the Made in America Chinese dance troupe, sets the stage for our talk with Made in China American artist and illustrator James McMullen. Best known for theater posters commissioned by New York's Lincoln Center, his latest work is a memoir, Leaving China, an artist paints his World War II childhood, new from Algonquin Books, Workman Publishing, with 50 original watercolor paintings. And to talk about the book, that childhood and his life since, Jim McMullen is on the line now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Some of the early chapters explain how your grandparents came to China in 1887 as missionaries. Were your detailed paintings of that period based primarily on photographs, family tales, or artistic imagination?
Well, for the earlier part of the book, there really was very little documentation of a visual sort that I could use. So it was pretty much imagination and, of course, stories that my mother had told me about my grandparents.
For moments you actually recalled, which came first, descriptive words or the paintings?
I had to, let's say, organize myself through the writing, but I don't think there was ever a time that The images were far from my mind.
And you've said your paintings for this book were much influenced by the Chinese art on the walls of your first home. Talk about that style and why you chose it.
Well, I'm talking about primarily the scroll paintings, the landscape scroll paintings, and probably the most obvious thing that I took from those paintings is the point of view that typically what you see in a landscape painting of that genre is that the artist seems to be standing on a high hill looking down at a scene probably near a river with a pavilion with little figures drinking tea, and then up at the tops of the mountains with the clouds swirling around them. So I've always been tremendously attracted to that idea of making paintings which are very much about figures operating in a larger sphere.
Your family's history in China is remarkable. Talk about how missionary work led to an orphanage for abandoned girl babies, to a trade school for them, to international commerce.
Yes, yes. I mean, in one way, it would seem the usual imperialist story of missionaries going in and kind of finding a way to profit from the life there. But the thing was that they actually saved these girls by rescuing them from this tower in the cemetery to which their parents had taken them and abandoned them. And they taught them English. They became Christians. They taught them the Bible, and they taught them this trade. So as a matter of reality, they actually gave these girls a fairly good life. And as I note in the book, they were much in demand as wives because they could speak English. They were Christians, and at that point in time in China, that was a good thing to be. And they knew a trade. The trade was called cutwork embroidery, which was very popular in those days, where patterns are cut out of a linen cloth, and then the edges are sewn, bound up in this embroidery, and the apertures, flowers and other kinds of decorative elements are embroidered into each of these aperture shapes. And that became the thing that the McMullen Company was, I guess, well known for in those years. And they made linens of various sorts and tablecloths and napkins and even gloves, actually, ladies' gloves. They were sold, eventually, they were sold in America and England.
You write about your father's love of music, including songs from a Cole Porter show that later became the subject of perhaps your most famous poster, Anything Goes. Did it strike you as something special when you got that assignment?
It did indeed. That era of music, very much because of hearing my father sing it, had always meant a great deal to me. And the songs of Anything Goes seemed to personify my love of that style more than anything else, and the whole idea of Cole Porter. And I'm sure that my father, as he played the piano, tried to imagine that he was Cole Porter.
You write about the endless anxiety you experience with all the traumatic moments, the coming in of the Japanese forces, movements of your young life. You think all that left you with lasting emotional scars or made you more resilient in the end?
Well, I think it did make me more resilient because I became a survivor. I mean, that my sense of the world was that I was not going to be given easy passage and that I had to, in some ways, protect myself.
Illustrator James McMullen is best known for theater posters commissioned by New York's Lincoln Center. His latest work is a memoir, Leaving China. An artist paints his World War II childhood. New from Algonquin Books, Workman Publishing, with 50 original watercolor paintings. We wish him well with it.
And here's another quote from the news. Any person who actually thought my Twitter feed was literally about verbatim conversations is an idiot. That was writer John Lefavre after Simon & Schuster canceled publication of his book based on what turned out to be embarrassing but fictitious talk overheard in the elevator at financial giant Goldman Sachs.
Next, have you met Miss Jones? Actress-singer Shirley Jones, for Your Ears Only. A last chorus for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. The dignity we seek in dying must be found in the dignity with which we have lived. That was the conclusion of the award-winning 1996 book How We Die by Dr. Sherwin Nuland, who died himself last week at age 83. Now this.
If I loved you, words wouldn't come in an easy way. Round in circles I go.
She landed her first Broadway role by happenstance in a show by two men whose names she says she didn't even know, Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein's South Pacific. Shirley Jones went on to fame on film in their musicals Oklahoma and Carousel. Later she starred as the singing mom in TV's Partridge Family. But despite her bright golden Hammerstein image, Jones was always a little more Hart at heart, as in Larry Hart, Rodgers' first collaborator, who wrote The Lady is a Tramp, Ants Invading My Pants, and the devilish double entendre, Wish That You Were There Again to Get Into My Hair Again.
Last year, Shirley Jones shocked her Good Girl fans with an eponymous memoir spiced with sexual awakening and orgasmic experimentation, marital and otherwise. It's just been republished as a paperback by Gallery Simon & Schuster, as Jones sings both Hart and Hammerstein and some other great standards in the intimate setting of Manhattan's posh Café Carlyle. And to talk about the show, the book, and her life on stage and off, for Your Ears Only, Shirley Jones is on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Rodgers and then Hammerstein personally came to your audition for a chorus role in South Pacific, and we read that you were the only singer they ever had under personal contract.
That's right.
Did they ever say over the years what made you so special to them?
I have no idea. I really don't. I think I was so new and so young and you know, so unaware of really what show business was about that they felt maybe they had to do that. And didn't want me working for anybody else at that time, you know.
And how were they to work with once you got their names down?
They were wonderful, just wonderful. I mean, Hammerstein was a gem of a man. And Rodgers, too. You know, I mean, they worked very well together. But Hammerstein truly made the decisions there.
In terms of lyrics, Hammerstein was mostly the high-minded one, while Hart was often more low-down, and Rodgers' music with Hart was also lower, which you've said better suits your voice as you approach the age of 80 next month. Talk about how you come to terms with your changing voice and how you keep it in shape.
Well, it's not easy. Right now I have a bad cold, believe it or not, and I'm having a hard time. I haven't had a cold in years, and I got a cold when I got here. And last night I had trouble singing, but I have to tell you the audiences here are so wonderful, and I can sing the low songs, I can sing the very high songs, the middle range is very, you know, particularly with the cold, really terrible, but I told them that and they were wonderful. They said, you don't have to sing, just stand there.
Some say Rodgers' music also was simpler with Hart, more complex and with longer phrases with Hammerstein, maybe because his words came first. Do you notice that when you sing the songs of both together in a show?
Yeah, I think so. I think, Rodgers and Hart, you know, it was a very different sound that they had together. You know, Hammerstein was much more, Broadway. I think Hart was just all over the place, you know, And I love both of them. I mean, I love their song. I love Rodgers and Hart.
We know about you as a sweetheart of movie musicals, but talk about how you got your Oscar-winning role as a prostitute in Elmer Gantry with Burt Lancaster and how you got into that character.
Well, that was Burt's doing. You know, Burt got me the job because, the director, Richard Brooks, did not want me. He wanted Piper Laurie, and he didn't want me at all. And, you know, I can understand that because I hadn't done any dramatic things. And Burt had saw me on a Playhouse 90 with Red Skelton called The Big Slide. And I played an alcoholic sunshine girl in the Maxine era. And he decided that I was right for the part of Lulu Baines. And so that's how I got the part. And he fought for me. And I, as I tell the story, you know, the first day that I had to shoot, I got no direction at all from Mr. Brooks. He just sat there. And I had the hardest scene I had to do in the film, which was, you know, the scene in the House of Prostitution where I tell the ladies how I met Elmer Gantry. And he gave me no direction. And the next day I didn't have to shoot. And he saw my rushes of the day before. And he called me and he said, "Shirley, I owe you an apology. Not only are you going to be great in this film, but I predict you're going to win an Academy Award."
How do you compare singing in a cabaret like the Café Carlyle with your work in theater, movies, concert halls, and TV?
Well, I haven't done much of this kind of work. You know, I played Feinstein's before it closed, and that was the first time I ever played a club like that and like this. But I wasn't sure, you know, that I would be able to do it or people would accept me doing it. And I find that I really love it. I love. It's like I'm in somebody's living room singing, you know. And it's a lovely feeling, and the people are so warm and open and right there. You know, I feel like I can sit down and have a conversation with each one of them.
And do you have a favorite song or show that you really prize?
Well, I love Carousel. It's my favorite music of all time. I think it's the most beautiful music that Richard Rodgers ever wrote. And he agreed with me. He thought it was his finest work. And I love that one.
Oscar-winning actress and singer Shirley Jones. Read all about her in Shirley Jones, a memoir just out in paper from Gallery Simon & Schuster. And hear an evening with Shirley Jones through March 15th at the Café Carlyle. That's 35 East 76th Street in New York.
Once you told me I was mistaken, that I'd awaken with the sun and order orange juice for one. It never entered my mind.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is also online at iTunes, FeedBurner.com, and Stitcher.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions. With intern Sarah Skirmont and Gene Moon, I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davideearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Jean Moon. This week last year, we considered the passing of Venezuela's charismatic leader Hugo Chavez and what might follow from our March 10, 2013 broadcast hosted by David and Eddie Robinson.
Patria socialista muerte! ¡Venceremos, muchachos!
Que confirmaron la existencia de un tumor abscesado.
A las 4:25 de la tarde de hoy, 5 de marzo, ha fallecido el comandante presidente Hugo Chávez Frías.
Venezuela's charismatic leftist leader Hugo Chávez had bravely announced his cancer to his people personally. But after that, his off and on treatment in Cuba and his condition there remained a mystery, stirred by frequent rumors of his death and anger at the questionable legitimacy of his continuation in office. All that came to an end last week as Vice President Nicolas Maduro announced that Chavez had indeed finally died at the age of 58.
The funeral drew thousands of the poor who adored him, 32 heads of state, including Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Hollywood star Sean Penn, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who offered both prayer and praise for Chavez. Hugo fed the hungry, he lifted the poor, he raised their hopes. Not stressed were lingering problems of murderous crime, corruption, constrained civil liberties, and Maduro's earlier charge that Washington caused the fatal cancer. To consider what's ahead for Venezuela, its impact on the region and on U.S. foreign policy in the hemisphere, we're joined again by Larry Burns, director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington. Welcome to the program.
David.
What do you see as Venezuela's greatest gains under Chavez?
I think it probably went a long way in recapturing Latin America for Latin Americans. The debate was no longer the nature of U.S. influence over Latin America, because that's pretty much gone. And Chavez was a monumental force in using the country's oil revenues to his critics would say to buy friendships. His admirers would say that he was willing to share Venezuela's wealth with the rest of Latin America. But whatever the motivation, Chavez built up a huge popular following and, in a sense, neutralized the skeptics to a very, who felt that Chavez was all air and no reality. He proved to have a vision that might turn out to be very durable of a Latin America that no longer was in the thrall of the United States, but was now capable of sound economic development and meaningful trade relations.
And what about complaints of dictatorial practices and policy failures, crime, corruption, and a lack of comprehensive development?
In terms of corruption, there was plenty of corruption. But you could have used the same words for any country in Latin America, including Brazil, including Costa Rica. These countries have huge indices of corruption. In terms of violence, there was almost none. That is, even his critics are hard put to generate a case against Chavez or Chavistas that involved violence. So he was certainly not a cruel man. He was no General Pinochet at all. He was a person. He was silly at times. He was mirthful, loved to tell jokes. He never was too convinced of his own omnipotence. I think that history will be kind to him. Kind to him because even after his admitted shortcomings are discounted from his personality, there's a lot left there, a lot left of an extraordinarily vital figure who was willing to experiment with state power and also left some very important institutions which he helped found, like UNASUR and other regional bodies.
Chavez will not be buried but embalmed and put on display in a museum. But how long can his policies and priorities, Chavismo, continue without his personal charisma, even if his designated successor Maduro wins a mandated election?
Well, of course, that's a wonderful question, and I don't really know the answer. I will say that, I didn't go too much for the crystal sort of device that he's going to be napping in. I mean, I felt that that was, that's a lot of Evita Perón to that. But unfortunately, that was very much his personality. And so it's not out of sync that this is what he would want to do. In terms of the longevity of the policy, Venezuela is in very poor shape right now. It has a very high inflation rate. It has a huge outstanding debt. But it also has oil, and that oil will give the Chavista planners a opportunity to make vital economic reforms in order that the whole thing doesn't come crashing down. He also has the unshakable loyalty of the poor, and as long as he's able to provide economic comfort to the poor, he's going to have their support. Now, the heirs to the to Hugo Chavez are you don't have his magnetic appeal and his galvanic grasp on the people. They're going to be hard put to duplicate that. But what it really indicates is that the right to succession from one administration to another, democracies of the traditional nature have a huge benefit over sort of charismatic regimes like that of Hugo Chavez. That you can't change, and that's not going to be an easy job for Chavez's heirs to transit.
Larry Burns is director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington.
After Chavez, from a March 10, 2013 broadcast. Months of angry protests against chronic product shortages, 56% inflation, and excessive use of force under the Maduro government have left at least 20 dead, including a police officer and a civilian last week. 11 of 55 people detained for alleged crimes connected with the protests are reportedly security officers. Also last week, President Maduro cut diplomatic and political ties with Panama. He called it a U.S. lackey working against Venezuela, primarily for its proposal of peacemaking efforts between his government and protesters by the Organization of American States, of which the U.S. is a member. I'm Jean Moon. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, Shirley Jones again with a song from the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical State Fair on the old Danny Thomas TV show.
The things I used to like, I don't like anymore. I want a lot of other things I've never had before. It's just like Papa says, I sit around and mope, pretending I am wonderful, and knowing I'm a dope. I'm as restless as a willow in a windstorm. I'm as jumpy as a puppet on a string. I'd say that I had spring fever, but I know I am starry-eyed and vaguely discontented, like a nightingale without a song to sing. Oh, why should I have spring fever when it isn't even spring? I keep wishing I was somewhere else, walking down a strange new street, hearing words that I have never heard from a man I've yet to meet. I'm as busy as a spider spinning daydreams. I'm as giddy as a baby on a swing. I haven't seen a crocus or a rosebud or a robin on the wing, but I feel so gay in a melancholy way that it might as well be spring. It might.